French talks between EU and UK show no sign of breaking an impasse over post-Brexit fishing rights. China's military says it has tailed a U.S. warship as it passed through the sensitive Taiwan Strait. And Iraqi officials and MPs pay tribute to top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, who were assassinated by the U.S. nearly a year ago. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, post-Brexit, trade negotiations between the UK and the EU have entered another critical period as an agreement remains elusive. The two sides are amid a deadlock over fishing rights as the main stumbling block in the ongoing talks in Brussels. A EU diplomat said it remains, quote, very blocked. Another said Brussels had made London its last offer on the issue. He warned that it will be a no deal if Britain refuses the proposal. The European Parliament has demanded an agreement by midnight on Sunday to review for ratification before the end of the year. If no deal is reached by that time, the two sides will have to rely on the World Trade Organization rules to govern future trade. Now, that could lead to an increase in prices.
The EU's chief negotiator says there is a chance of getting a Brexit agreement, but the path to such an agreement is very narrow. Both sides are calling for compromise. The UK wants EU boats to lose automatic access to British fishing waters, but the EU says if that happens, the UK will have to pay.
Nous l'acceptons et nous le respectons. Mais si le Royaume-Uni veut...
If the United Kingdom wants, after a credible, sufficient period of adjustment, to be able to cut off access to its waters for European fishermen when it wants to, the European Union needs to have sovereign rights to react or to compensate that.
Mr. Barnier says the EU will not sign a deal that will undercut its single market of 450 million consumers. For its part, the UK says it cannot agree to become the only country in the world that does not have sovereign control of its fisheries. Westminster certainly doesn't want nearly $1 trillion worth of EU-UK trade to be hit with tariffs and quotas beyond December 31st. And so, hours before yet another deadline, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has warned that a no-deal scenario is very likely unless the EU position changes substantially.
The UK's got to be able to control its own laws, it's what people voted for, and we've also got to be able to control our waters and our fishing rights. It's obviously also what people voted for, and no sensible government is going to agree to a treaty that doesn't have those two basic things in it as well as everything else. Our door is open, we'll keep talking, but I have to say that things are looking difficult.
Meanwhile, long queues are forming as trucks and lorries try to cross into continental Europe. Logistics companies have reported a surge in demand for imports ahead of a potential no-deal Brexit as companies rush to stockpile. If a deal is not reached by the 31st of December, the UK will have to start trading on World Trade Organization rules. Boris Johnson has called on UK businesses to prepare for such an eventuality. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Oil prices have surged to near nine-month highs amid optimism about COVID-19 vaccine rollouts and a U.S. coronavirus relief package. U.S. crude on Friday rose over 1.5% to above $49 per barrel. Brent had the same increase and topped $52. Market analysts say the launch of COVID vaccinations in several countries has paved the way for increased demand of oil-related products. Adding further support to prices was a prospect of a new stimulus package in the U.S. to help the economy there. A recent rise in COVID-19 cases has weakened the world's economic outlook and hit global demand for oil. China's military says it has tailed and monitored a U.S. warship as it passed through the Taiwan Strait. The Chinese military said the Saturday move by the U.S. deliberately raises the temperature of the Taiwan issue. It's that the move sends flirtatious glances to supporters of Taiwan's independence and jeopardizes peace and stability in the Strait. China also accused the U.S. of using the Taiwan issue as a pawn for what it calls selfish strategic purposes. The U.S. Navy said its guided missile destroyer was on a routine mission in accordance with international law. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory and is opposed to increased U.S. support for the island. The incumbent president there says Taiwan is an independent country. Well, the New York Police Department is found to have used excessive force to stop protests against police racism and brutality in the summer. New York City's Department of Investigation said police use of excessive force and crowd control tactics fueled tensions during the protests. It said officers made mass arrests, used batons and pepper spray, and beat protesters indiscriminately. Now, the report noted that the measures impinged on protesters' right to assemble and express their views. The investigation was called in May after social media were flooded with videos of officers' violence, including in one instance ramming police vehicles into a crowd of protesters. Well, the rallies were part of the protests over the killing of unarmed African-American George Floyd, which soon morphed into the worst civil unrest in the U.S. in decades. I'd like to welcome my guests for this news review. Out of Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell, and out of Tampa, Florida, Mike Malcolm, Director of Black People's Advancement and Defense Organization. Thank you both for being with us, starting off with Colin. Well, Colin, give us an overall view on what exactly this investigation has found.
Hi, Marzia. Well, the investigation really looked at the ways that police treated protesters during that time of tension, and it showed that police officers showed a woeful lack of adept attention to this matter in trying to address the protests, the size of the protests, and how they did it. And, of course, this is on par for police tactics whenever there's interruption, whenever there's unrest over a disparate situation, mainly when it comes to situations regarding color in this nation. There seems to be an over-responsiveness and an overcorrection. And what we saw from this report is that police were not adequately trained. They did not use the proper strategy. They did not use the proper protocols when addressing these crowds. And that's why you're seeing some high criticism of the police officers now, and that's why you're hearing the mayor of New York saying that it's a time for reflection. Some may say those are empty words, but he has put them out there as a time that police strategy and police tactics need to be revised and addressed.
Well, let's turn to Life. Life, your take on it all. I mean, we've heard, perhaps we've heard this before. Do you think that this time around there's going to actually be some concrete action to change that reality on the ground?
Hello, Marzia. I'm not sure if there's be any concrete action. What I do know is when we call this the worst civil unrest, that characterizes the civil unrest for a certain component of America, the United States. On the other hand, and in my view, it was the best of the civil unrest we've seen in decades. It's absolutely necessary that African and others who live in the U.S. under the colonial domination imposed upon us every day, it's absolutely imperative that we rise up. But on the other hand, for the other part of America, the colonizer, it is absolutely necessary for the colonizer to use their military arm, otherwise known as the police department, to be the most vicious, brutal, and ruthless as they possibly can be to keep the colonized from rising up. So this kind of idea that the police have displayed some kind of lack of training or unpreparedness is tomfoolery. The reality is the New York Police Department and other colonial institutions, such as the New York Police Department in the U.S., were not prepared for the massive use of video and stuff that the people now have so that they can expose the brutality that has always existed in the U.S. when it comes to the contest between the colonizers and the colonized.
Well, life in general, what do you think? I mean, what is going to change this around? Because you said you're not sure about this particular investigation, if it's going to lead to anything concrete and change anything. And we've seen this, of course, over the decades, over the centuries, perhaps. What is it going to take to change that reality on the ground? I mean, and you talked about this systemic racism, that it's not because of a lack of training, but the system was set up in order to do exactly what it's going to do. If that is the case, what can be done to change that reality?
So for me, racism is some kind of abstract idea. That's why I always talk about colonialism, because that is a material reality. It's a power struggle between the colonizer and the colonized. And what has to happen is the colonized have to continue to organize ourselves. That's why it was some of the best civil unrest that we've seen since the perhaps since the 1960s. African and other oppressed people in the United States used this awful, brutal murder of George Floyd to have this spontaneous and a very courageous, spontaneous response to the colonial conduct that we endure all the time. Now we have to corral that spontaneity and that that energy that we saw over the summer and harness it in an organized response that can beat back, beat down, and eventually crush and kill the colonial domination we suffer every day. So there's nothing that the colonizer will ever do except for offer these ersatz apologies, so you know, and excuses of unpreparedness and lack of training and what have you, sort of like the Novocaine in the jar that Malcolm X spoke about to keep us suffering peacefully. That's the only thing that the colonizer can ever offer. It is the responsibility of colonized people like Africans and others oppressed in the United States to organize and take the momentum generated by these spontaneous movements to a level of revolutionary practice to overturn the social system we live in now.
Well, life, really quickly, we just have about 30 seconds, but your prognosis for 2021, do you think that we're going to see this type of continued unrest in the United States or not?
Absolutely. Okay. Short enough?
Definitely short enough. Thank you very much. Appreciate both of you being with us. Colin Campbell out of Washington, D.C. Life Malcolm, a director of Black People's Advancement and Defense Organization out of Tampa, Florida. Well, continuing with more news this hour, turning to Iraq, where officials and parliamentarians have held a ceremony to pay tribute to top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, who were assassinated by the U.S. back in January. Now, the chairman of the Popular Mobilization Forces, Fali al-Fayyad, hailed Soleimani and Abu Mohandes for their anti-terror efforts. He underlined that the two commanders sacrificed their lives to protect the Iraqi nation against their enemies. He called General Soleimani and his companion heroes of the Iraqi nation. He stressed that the Popular Mobilization Forces will remain loyal to them and their ideals. General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes were killed in a U.S. drone strike in Iraq. The killing sparked anti-American sentiments in Iraq and prompted lawmakers to approve a bill demanding the complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from that country. And now to Indian-administered Kashmir, where the first major electoral process after the abrogation of Kashmir's special status has concluded. The elections were held amid tight security with fears of attacks by pro-independence fighters. Now, the results of these local elections will be announced on December the 22nd. Our correspondent, Shahana Bhatt, brings us more.
Local elections in Indian-administered Kashmir, held in 8 phases, have come to an end. The voting process has remained by and large peaceful amid stringent security measures. After the revocation of Kashmir's special status, regional political parties had refused to participate in the electoral process as a sign of protest against India's decision to strip Kashmir of its autonomous status. That resulted in the strengthening of the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party in the Muslim-majority region. However, this time, the regional parties formed an alliance to take part in the local elections. Compared to the past, a large number of people came forth to cast their ballots.
Since the BJP came to power in India, it started taking decisions against minorities. The BJP has taken Kashmir's autonomy, Kashmiris' jobs, and now they are eyeing land. They don't care about the people of Kashmir. We came to cast our votes against those people who only aim to destroy Kashmir's ethnicity, in the name of mainstreaming Kashmir.
More and more people in Kashmir have developed skepticism on the overall electoral process after scores of video interviews of the District Development Council or DDC candidates started circulating on social media. A number of candidates have no idea what positions they are running for in the local administration, and even worse, some have no idea what DDC means.
Kashmir, man.
In order for votes to be equally distributed, the Election Commission has accepted nominations from all sorts of people. There is no set prerequisite for candidates. I wonder who they are empowering. How can an uneducated person with no idea of economy, finance, and politics seek equal rights and development for me? Basically, they do not need educated people. They want stooges who will implement what the Indian government will decide for us, without thinking about people's interests.
This is the first time that DDC elections are being held. Members of the DDC are expected to prepare and approve district plans and expenditure schemes, which will replace the district planning and development boards in all districts across the region. Earlier, district development boards looked after the planning, approval, or implementation of centrally sponsored schemes. The result of the eight-phase elections will be announced on December 22nd. Apparently, the elections in Kashmir have paved the way for other electoral processes in the volatile region. However, many say this ballot has made the people of Kashmir politically aware of the fact that New Delhi is trying to thrust such electoral processes in order to create an impression that normalcy has taken hold after it stripped Kashmir of its autonomy. Actually, without building trust and bridging the gaps. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
And with that from Shahana brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
By handing out masks late, forcing detained people into close quarters, refusing to release the medically vulnerable, not reporting infections, testing inadequately, frequently transferring detainees and pressuring staff and guards to continue working despite compromised health, USICE's handling of the pandemic has led to over 7,000 reported positive cases and at least 8 coronavirus-related deaths among detained people, says John Washington, writer, in an article published under the heading, USICE Mismanagement Created Coronavirus Hotbeds of Infection in and Around Detention Centers. Stay tuned for the details of this article. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement's response to the COVID-19 pandemic has been a horrifying and avoidable calamity. By handing out masks late, forcing detained people into close quarters, refusing to release the medically vulnerable, not reporting infections, testing inadequately, frequently transferring detainees and pressuring staff and guards to continue working despite compromised health. ICE's handling of the pandemic has led to over 7,000 reported positive cases and at least 8 coronavirus-related deaths among detained people. A new report from Detention Watch Network finds that the dire situation inside also led to wider consequences. When a spread in the communities surrounding detention centers is included, ICE's sprawling incarceration system added nearly 250,000 cases to the total U.S. caseload. The WN report, Hotbeds of Infection, released recently, lays bare how ICE's abundant failures and dilatory mismanagement killed and infected people inside detention centers and significantly contributed to the spread of COVID-19 cases across the U.S. By August 1st, almost 5.5% of total U.S. cases, according to the report, were attributable to spread from ICE detention centers. The report is yet another damning indication that ICE's dereliction in protecting basic human rights, grievous medical neglect, and lack of transparency in how it detains and treats people in its system of over 200 detention centers is a massive public health threat, both to detainees and the greater U.S. population. The impact of ICE's failure to adequately respond to the pandemic was far-reaching and multi-layered, the WN report says. Even as COVID-19 cases have surged across the U.S., ICE has ramped up enforcement activities, creating a recipe for disaster for those in detention and surrounding communities. The report's authors were at pains to explain that it is not immigrants who spread disease, but rather the immigration detention regime, the nature of incarceration and all it entails, that forces disease and sickens migrants and communities alike. It is setting up ideal lab conditions for incubating viruses and putting them out into the community, said Gregory Hooks, a professor of sociology at McMaster University and co-author of DWN report. Dr. Ranit Mishori, a Georgetown University School of Medicine professor and senior medical advisor at Physicians for Human Rights, said, "The United States has a long history of scapegoating immigrants for the spread of infectious diseases, yet medical evidence suggests that punitive immigration enforcement, such as packing detention facilities or scaring immigrants away from accessing medical care, is the true threat to the public health." Daniel Bennett, an ICE spokesperson, told The Intercept that since the outbreak, the agency has taken extensive steps to safeguard all detainees, staff, and contractors, including reducing the number of detainees in custody by placing individuals on alternatives to detention programs, suspending social visitation, incorporating social distancing practices with staggered meals and recreation times, and through the use of testing, cohorting, and medical isolation. Between May 1st and August 1st, the DWN report found ICE detention facilities were responsible for over 245,000 COVID-19 cases throughout the U.S. If a separate country had reported the number of COVID-19 cases attributed just to ICE detention facilities at that point, it would have ranked 16th in the world, having a higher case rate than Germany, France, and Canada. The infection rate inside immigration detention centers was 13 times higher than that of the general U.S. population, which would have, taken together, made them by far the most contagious country in the world, according to the World Health Organization stats. Hotbeds of Infection takes advantage of county-level data on coronavirus infections made available by the New York Times. The authors examine links between IC detention facilities and confirmed cases of COVID-19 in nearby counties. Focusing on initial spread of COVID-19 and based on logistic regression modeling, the report provides evidence that COVID-19 arrived sooner, in April and May, and outbreaks were more severe in counties with ICE facilities as well as in neighboring counties. Over the summer, there was a sharp contrast between counties situated in multi-county economic areas with a high number of people detained by ICE and counties situated in areas with fewer people detained. As the pandemic spiraled out of control over the summer, the healthcare system in economic areas with a significant ICE presence were burdened by thousands of additional COVID-19 cases. Recognizing that other factors besides the presence of detention centers contribute to increased COVID-19 cases, the authors included a range of control variables, including but not limited to the presence of nursing homes, meat packing plants, other high-density living quarters including prisons, military bases or universities, population density, and the percentage of non-white populations who continue to suffer the worst of the pandemic. After taking into account these other variables, the analysis showed a statistically significant relationship between the presence of an ICE detention center and the exacerbation of the COVID-19 outbreak in the surrounding multi-county area. The advocacy group Freedom for Immigrants reports that over half of immigration detention centers in the U.S. are currently reporting coronavirus outbreaks. According to WN report, California, Texas, and Arizona had by far the most COVID-19 cases resulting from the presence of ICE detention facilities. ICE wasn't only responsible for imperiling people detained and for spreading the virus to surrounding communities, it was also spreading the virus abroad. By continuing deportations, even while the U.S.-Mexico border was almost completely shut down for migrants and asylum seekers, ICE exported the virus to Guatemala, Haiti, Mexico, El Salvador, and India, all countries with few intensive care beds, few respirators, and relatively meager health systems, particularly vulnerable to viral spread. Last spring, at one point, people deported from the United States made up as much as 20% of all known COVID-19 cases in Guatemala. In 2020 fiscal year, ICE deported 164,455 people from the U.S., potentially sending thousands or even tens of thousands of cases throughout the world. Attorneys, advocates, detainees, and even judges began sounding the alarm about COVID-19 cases in immigration detention system in March, but ICE failed to heed the calls to take significant preventive measures. Early on the pandemic, the Philadelphia Inquirer reported that ICE was not providing detainees with proper information about the coronavirus. The Intercept reported that a detention center in Georgia, while engaging in a host of medically dangerous practices, was ignoring and underreporting coronavirus cases. In April, a federal judge ordered ICE to consider a release of all detainees over the age of 55 due to risks from coronavirus, ruling that ICE has shown medical indifference and put people with serious medical conditions or disabilities at substantial risk of harm. Overall, though, very few people were released. Thousands got sick. Meanwhile, medical staff, administrators, vendors, visitors, and guards have been bringing the virus into detention centers across the U.S. and carrying out the virus out, with ICE doing little and sometimes nothing to contain the spread on both sides of the bars. Immigration detention centers, the report grimly notes, have been among the deadliest of public institutions during the COVID-19 pandemic. The U.S. immigration detention system has a history of medically neglect, dehumanizing, squalid, and sometimes deadly conditions, including previous viral outbreaks that far predate the COVID-19 crisis. Just in fiscal year 2020, a total of 20 people died in ICE detention centers. For years, experts have repeatedly condemned the agency for violating basic health standards, keeping detained people locked up for prolonged periods, abusing them, even torturing them, and placing them at high risk for mental and physical decline. In 2019, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform and its Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties began investigating troubling report of in-custody death of adults and children, as well as deficient medical care, improper treatment, and filthy conditions at facilities operated by both ICE and Customs and Border Protection and other immigration enforcement agencies under the umbrella of Department of Homeland Security. They found a widespread failure to provide necessary medical care to detainees with serious and chronic medical conditions, along with critical medical staff shortages. The conditions, in other words, were perfect for a rapacious virus to take hold. Hotbeds of Infection is the first report to build on the investigations into the dangers within detention centers and looks closely at the risks they pose to communities where they are located. Evidence points to detention centers sparking infections early in the pandemic and making outbreaks worse, the report says. The multi-county area surrounding detention centers with the highest number of people detained saw a 20% increase in COVID-19 caseloads. Hooks, the report co-author, said, "I think of prisons and detention centers as ongoing super spreader of events."
Ocean of Dua.
Thumma inni as'aluka al-huda wa at-taqwa wal-'afafa wal-ghina.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear listeners, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Rarsi, and we're gonna be with you with another edition of the Ocean of Dua. In this version of the program, inshallah, we will discuss the true meaning of prayer and dua, the value of prayer, ways of reaching the Almighty Allah, acceptance, and also benefits of dua. So stay with us. Talking about the term love, or hub, specifically in our supplications, discussing its twofold action and also different levels and stages of love, we got to know how important this point is in our supplications. Now, the state of intimacy that is reached through love of the Almighty Allah, the state of finding rest with Him,
feeling safe under his shelter, is a state which springs forth from the feeling that one is in the presence, that one is in proximity and company of Allah the Exalted. This is the best of the states a servant could ever be before the Almighty Allah. However, this state does not represent everything as far as the relation of man with Allah is concerned. Rather, the state of intimacy with Allah must be accompanied by the state of shawq, so that it may reach completion, be balanced and well coordinated. So we need the element of shawq in all our supplications.
Alhamdulillah, khaliq al-khalq, basit al-rizq, faliq al-asbah, dhil jalal wal-ikram, wal-fadl wal-in'am, alladhi ba'uda fala yura, wa qaruba fashahida an-najwa.
So when we have a closer look at the ibadullah, which are the true friends of the Almighty Allah, some of the time, the attribute of shawq and longing for Allah is dominant over their worship and relationship with Him, while at other times, the attribute of intimacy and rest becomes dominant over their worship, over their remembrance and their relation with Allah. And sometimes, both attributes may dominate their worship, which is in fact the best and the healthiest of states, and the nearmost to the state of equilibrium and harmony in relation with Allah. Hamad bin Habib Attar al-Kufi says, "When we came out as pilgrims, we were struck with a dark, sandy storm as a result of which the caravan got dispersed." He continues saying, "I lost my way in that desert and land until I reached an uninhabited valley. When night fell, I took shelter in an ordinary tree. When it got completely dark, I suddenly saw a young man coming, wearing white, tattered garment with fragrance of musk emanating from him. So I said to myself, 'This is one of Allah's friends.' Whenever he sensed any movement from me, I feared that he would go away, and I feared it would stop him from what he intended to do. So I hid myself as much as I could. He came near to the place and prepared himself for prayers. Then he stood up praying while he said, 'O he who has taken everything under his control and who has conquered everything by his power, make the joy of turning toward you enter my heart and admit me to the domain of those who obey you.' Then he began to offer prayers."
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo kashti onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedast. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad ab az bala va pas. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you.
Paradise, thank you Allah that we hear not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of Dua.
Hamad continues, dear listeners, and says, in the final hours of the night, he stood up and said, O he whom the seekers had inspired and found him to be their guide, and the fearful sought refuge in and found him to be full of grace, and the worshippers took shelter in him and found him to be the bestower of favors. Then did he who erected his body for other than you find ease? And when has he become happy, one who aspired other than you in intention? O Allah, the darkness is disappearing while I have not been able to accomplish even a little of your service, and my whispering to you has been but inconsiderable. Send your blessings on Muhammad and his progeny, and do to me what is worthy of you out of the two things, O most merciful of the merciful. And then Hamad said, I fear that this person may escape me and his trace may remain hidden to me. So I could reach him, and I said to him, by him who has got you rid of the weariness and has bestowed upon you yearning and pleasure of desire, who are you? He said, since you have sworn, I am Ali ibn al-Husayn, Ali ibn Abi Talib. So, dear listeners, this is the state of ibadah, the true sense of worship that we're talking about. We need shawq and longing, and also we need intimacy and rest to become dominant over our worships. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Snake bites annually cost India's citizens the equivalent of 3 million years of health and productivity. That figure, reported at a meeting last month, puts the spotlight on survivors of their snake bites who are left with disabling conditions such as amputation, kidney disease, and severe scarring. Stay with us for an article penned by Carrie Arnold, a commentator and writer under the heading Snake Bite Steals Millions of Years of Quality Life in India. Stay with us for more of Carrie Arnold's article. The analysis provides the first estimation of the toll of snake bites on survivors in India. It also confirms an earlier calculation showing that over half of the world's snake bite deaths occur in the country, demonstrating the need for greater investment in preventive measures. Snake bite is just still really not very well studied or understood at the same level as a lot of these other tropical diseases, says Nick Roberts, who was part of the team at the Seattle-based University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation that calculated the latest figures about snake bites. The World Health Organization, WHO, designated poisoning by snake bite a neglected tropical disease in 2017, and last year launched a global initiative to halve the number of deaths and disabilities it causes by 2030. The initiative highlights the need for better data, says Prabhat Jha, director of the Center for Global Health Research in Toronto, Canada. If the goal is to reduce snake bite deaths by half, then you need to know where the problems are. Because many people who are bitten by snakes never enter hospitals or healthcare centers, they're not formally recorded, and researchers frequently underestimate the impact of the snake bites across the globe. Snake bite also doesn't receive a lot of attention because it is a disease affecting mainly impoverished farmers and their families in rural areas. Snake bite disease takes a huge toll on India, partly because the subcontinent is home to so many different types of snakes. 60 of the country's nearly 300 species of snakes are highly venomous, explains Priyanka Kadam, president and founder of the Snake Bite Healing and Education Society, an organization in Mumbai, India. It can also be impossible for those bitten in remote parts of the country to get treatment because the nearest health clinic might be several hours away, she says. Even then, clinics don't always have anti-venom on hand, and if they do, it might not have been stored properly or be of good quality. Because so few of those poisoned by snake bites are treated in hospital, concrete data on the impact of the snake bites has been challenging to obtain. Global estimates of snake bite deaths have ranged from 50,000 to 125,000. In India alone, they have varied from 11,000 to 50,000. In 2011, Prabhat Jha and his colleagues tried to nail down more accurate estimates for snake bite deaths in India. He runs the Million Deaths Study, an effort to clarify causes of death in the country using verbal reports from family and physicians. On the basis of these reports, Prabhat Jha calculated that 45,900 snake bite deaths occurred each year in India, spurring officials to revise worldwide figures. Today, the World Health Organization gives a range of 81,000 to 138,000 annual snake bite deaths globally. The Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation at University of Washington in Seattle analysis provides the first quantitative information on the long-term effects for people who survive snake bites. Such estimates are important, says Kadam, because they can provide insight into healthcare costs and other societal burdens. The analysis also broadly supports Prabhat Jha's estimation of the number of snake bite deaths, finding that about 52,000 people died of snakebite in India last year. It used a different data source from Jha. However, the 2019 Global Burden of Disease study, this data set also used by the World Health Organization, provides worldwide estimates of illness and death for 369 diseases and injuries using official vital statistics and verbal autopsy reports, allowing scientists to compare the burden of snake bite between countries. Prabhat Jha, director of the Center for Global Health Research in Toronto, Canada, however, is critical of the accuracy of the latest analysis, contending that the GBD study uses complex and non-transparent models to determine how many people died and how. The University of Washington at Seattle's Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation has also caught heat recently for the transparency of its COVID-19 models, although those efforts remain separate from the snakebite work. Nick Roberts acknowledges that the GPD study isn't perfect, but said that our modeled estimates attempt to use high-quality data, correct possibly biases in the data, and create accurate estimates at scale. No matter what estimates are used, says Nick Roberts, the World Health Organization's goal to halve snakebite deaths and disabilities by 2030 is ambitious. We're not on track to meet it, he adds, given that snakebite deaths in India have declined only slightly, if at all, over the past decade. Kadam, whose organization works with scientists and policymakers to reduce the impact of snakebite in India, says the data shows an urgent need for a focused change at the policy level and access to basic healthcare services, particularly in rural areas where many people live.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. All praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master and Prophet, and upon his pure household, especially the one remaining with Allah on earth. Greetings be upon Hussein, upon Ali ibn al-Hussein, upon the children of Hussein, and upon the companions of Hussein. First of all, I wish to congratulate you, dear brave, experienced, and young graduates in our Armed Forces Academies, and also the arrival of young cadets in military academies to prepare themselves for passing through these glorious stages. Moreover, I would like to thank the Chief of the General Staff of the Armed Forces and the commanders in the Armed Force Academies for their brief and beneficial statements and reports. I also thank the Master of Ceremony for his eloquent speech. The organization of this ceremony at the same time and in the same place, during which all Armed Forces Academies gather together, contains a good piece of news: the emergence of an opportunity of the Armed Forces Academies to get close to one another, to benefit from each other's experiences, and to cooperate with and to help one another.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Their relationship is certainly to their benefit, and this ceremony has been organized in the illustrious Imam Ali alayhi salam Military Academy. I cannot forget that in the year 1359 in the Iranian calendar, in the beginning of the imposed war, a number of students from this academy went to the front, to Ahwaz and Susangerd, and engaged in fighting. They were still students, but they began their endeavor while they were still students. My dear ones, one of the things that gives value to an endeavor is the goal behind it. If we want to evaluate things, we should see what goals exist behind them. If this idea is correct, which is certainly correct, then studying in military academies and in armed forces organizations is one of the loftiest and most valuable endeavors. Why? It is so because by studying these universities, our youth enter the armed forces with the purpose of ensuring the security of the country, and security is a noble and fundamental value for the country.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.